Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, our reporter Simon Rios, back from a week in Puerto Rico. He traveled with one woman around the island to visit family, and every place they stopped, the struggle between hope for the future and despair at the devastation.
But I don't know. It's just hope, Simon. It's just hope. But sad, you know, these places were full of life. Full of life, all these places.
Also today, there's a buzzword for success in education.
One characteristic emerged as a significant predictor of success. And it wasn't social intelligence, and it wasn't IQ. It was grit.
But longtime Boston educator Linda Nathan says our obsession with grit is masking other problems of poverty and inequality. Plus, how does the notorious RBG stay so FIT? We'll examine the science behind Ruth Bader Ginsburg's workout. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Many of the TV trucks and news crews have left Puerto Rico, so we're no longer seeing the daily images of the devastated island, but the American humanitarian crisis remains there. 3.5 weeks after Hurricane Maria landed a direct hit, 85% of Puerto Rico remains without reliable power, 40% of people don't have cell service, a third lack safe drinking water. Well, WBUR reporter Simon Rios and photographer Jesse Costa were in Puerto Rico for 5 days last week. They're just back, and they've returned with some incredible stories, and they're here with me now in the studio. Hello, Simon.
Hello.
And hello, Jesse.
Hey, Meghna.
Our newsroom has been talking about the two of you and your reporting for days now, and it sounds like you had an incredible journey. You set off from Puerto Rico on Monday from Boston.
We did. We finally got onto a flight, and we were surprised to find it was only about a third or half full. Everybody on the plane had stories to tell, and one of them was really eager to talk to us. Her name was Yvonne Beltran. She's an attorney who lives in Revere, and she has several properties west of San Juan in Puerto Rico. She was traveling to the island to sort of check in on them and check in on her family. Yvonne was carrying a suitcase full of nails. She said $300 in nails that she got at Home Depot, as well as a chainsaw. And I wanted to find out where those materials were headed. So we met up with her the next day in a place called Arecibo.
Yeah. And Simone, and she wanted to talk to you because you were wearing an NPR shirt. Is that what you told me that earlier?
That
right?
would be correct.
Okay. So, well, back to the serious matter at hand. Arecibo, you met up with her. Where did you go first?
So in Arecibo, we met her on an off-ramp off the highway, and we went first to the town of Islotes. It's a touristy area right on the beach where she had a small property with three houses. The buildings were in surprisingly good shape compared to some of the structures we saw on the way in, probably because the property was protected from the ocean by a sort of knoll. Mm. Her cousin was there fixing the roof on one of the wooden houses on the property that had been beaten up pretty bad. That house was inhabited by one of Yvonne's tenants, a woman named Sarah Stein. She was born in Mass and she's lived in Puerto Rico for several years. Sarah, if you can believe this, she passed the storm by herself in Islote.
We were here and we looked out the window. We could see, check up on the house, and it was pretty crazy. The wind, just constant wind, really strong. It would just white out everything because of the sand, so you couldn't really see that good.
Wow. Just hearing Sarah describe it, it just kind of puts this image in my mind. But you were there. I mean, how did you react to what you were seeing, Simone?
It was all really surreal. I mean, the sheer amount of devastation, it's hard to process after you see so much of it. But, you know, I want to say that this place is a paradise. You know, you could see under all the destruction that it's one of the most beautiful places. But, you know, you can't help but having a feeling of deep sadness.
Yeah, I mean, and sort of evidence of that paradise is in your photos, Jesse. And I should tell everyone, if they go to radioboston.org, you can see a bunch of Jesse's pictures. And we've got them at WBUR.org as well. But I'm looking at one of them here, Jesse, of this place that Simone just described. And there's Yvonne. She's sort of standing, looking around, surrounded by palm trees that have just been mowed down. I mean, what was she feeling at this moment?
I mean, I think that she was just very devastated. I mean, we had been walking around the property, surveying things, and I was walking ahead and pointed out the trees. And as she made her way up to the top of the knoll, you know, you could tell that she was just devastated. And immediately after I took this photo, she just sat down next to the trees, as if she just had lost a friend. Huh. And it was just so sad to watch. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
Well, Yvonne has family all over the island, right, Simone? So where did she take you to next?
Yeah, mainly in the area west of San Juan. But so from Arecibo, we hopped in with her and headed to a place called Corozal. So Puerto Rico is divided by a mountain range called the Cordillera Central, the central mountain range, I guess. And it's in Corozal that she has roots going back generations.
Okay. And so, I mean, this is a car trip that you're taking, right? So what did you see on the way there?
On the way, we traveled through an area called Morovis. This was the worst we'd seen up until that point. The whole way, our mouths were just agape at the level of chaos and destruction. You know, I have to point out there's the human side of the tragedy, but there's also the environmental devastation that you almost even see more of. Everywhere you look, it's the trees are down and just massive trees that you wouldn't imagine ripped out of the ground. We stopped at one area where a stand of bamboo, and I'm not talking about the little house bamboo. I'm talking about, you know, plants as thick as a coffee mug. But, you know, hundreds of trees just flattened, laying against the mountainside. We stopped to take pictures of this, and we noticed that under a bridge, there was a family washing their clothes in a stream. They'd actually carved out a set of stairs into the mud with improvised bamboo railings and a shower stall made of zinc. Jacqueline Marrero was washing clothes for 5 family members. She told us nobody had come from the government to help.
Se supone que casa por casa lleven agua potable y no la llevan. Yo tengo que estar buscando agua, lavando en el río,
Marrero
cocinando a fogón.
Told us she heard the government was supposed to be bringing potable water from house to house, but she hadn't seen it. So now she's washing clothes in the stream and cooking over a fire.
And this is another one of your pictures, Jesse. This one just makes my heart stop. Right there they are. Yeah. She's washing clothes from a bucket from the stream. She's sitting right next to you.
Yeah, I was shocked. I was shocked that people are actually washing their clothes on a roadside stream. I had no words to say, but I knew that, you know, that we needed to photograph it. And so I ran down there immediately. I just felt so horrible for this family. Just words just can't describe.
You know, one of the things about your photo, which I think is most telling, is there's a bottle of Clorox right next to them. Because bleach,
I did notice that.
Well, with the environmental concerns and the possible spread of disease, bleach has to be far more important than it ever was before. But, I mean, Simone, they at least, I don't know, they have water of some kind. Are they one of the lucky ones?
They are. I mean, I asked Jacqueline about their house, and she said, thank God the house is still there, as well as the roof. You know, a lot of people's, you know, it's sort of three different situations. You have your house and your roof, or you have the house with no roof, or your house is just entirely gone. In her case, you know, they had their house and they had the roof. But there's no electricity or water, and food is scarce, even in the local market. And if you go to the local market, they only take cash. And, you know, nobody carries large amounts of cash on a regular basis. So you have to travel to the closest city and, you know, stand in line at an ATM. And that can take hours, right, as we all know.
Right. And again, just to remind folks, this is 3 weeks after the hurricane. So tell us then where you went next with Yvonne.
So we headed out from Morovis, headed to Corozal, and we would stop. She was great because, you know, she wanted to talk to the people. So she'd stop her pickup truck and, you know, hey, how are you guys doing? Have you seen the government? And just strike up a conversation. Everybody was good natured. And, you know, I'll say that almost, I mean, this isn't to say that the government isn't in Puerto Rico, but in terms of what we saw and the people that we talked to on this trip, nobody had heard from the government at the local, federal, state levels at all. In one case, actually, we were the first outsiders that people had seen. And like you said, yeah, 3 weeks into the hurricane.
Mm. And so then you went to go see more spots where Yvonne has family, right?
Yeah, so she has family in the municipality of Corozal, which is also in the mountains. You know, there's just so many sites. I noticed a wooden utility pole that had just snapped in half. That's how strong these winds were. Turned out her uncle lived in that property. We drove a little ways up the road, and there was a lumberyard and hardware store that her family had opened many years ago in Corozal. She says this is where her family's livelihood was from, that it allowed her to go to college and eventually practice law. This place was just, again, we keep using the word devastation because that's what it was. She didn't know if they'd be able to reopen it. She said the family was worried about, particularly about one of her uncles who operated the lumberyard.
I saw him in a video that my cousin, he was like completely destroyed. This was his life, you know, to be there, to help the people around, to sell the little nails, to present ideas to people to fix their houses. All the houses that you've seen around, many of those materials were from here. So, you know, this was his community. Life changed. Some people are able to adapt, but others don't.
You know, you can hear it in her voice. She was trying to be optimistic.
Yeah.
And she was, but she had serious doubts about whether this area would make a full recovery.
But at the same time, maybe because I am resilient, hopeful that maybe the people get like a push to try to fix things, try to do more agriculture. But I don't know. It's just hope, Simon. It's just hope. But sad, you know, these places were full of life, all these places.
You know, Simone, I'm thinking about when you first met Yvonne and the 300 nails or $300 worth of nails she had. I mean, like, it's just like you can hear in her voice there that that's how fundamental it is, that this is an island that's going to have to literally rebuild just nail by nail. That's what it makes me feel. Yeah. But I mean, or makes me think at least. What about the rest of Yvonne's family?
So after visiting the lumberyard, we went to see another uncle of hers in Corozal. His name is Gilberto Beltran. Gilberto works as a cook on a local beach. And he says everything is shut down. We're talking about two hurricanes because in this case, Irma came through,
right.
And shortly thereafter, and Hurricane Maria came, and they both caused major damage to this beach he works on. He says they're going to be out of business for 5 or 6 months. That's what he's thinking, and this is the this is how the family lives. This is their source of income. You know, when we arrived, his eyes were welling up, and he couldn't stop hugging Yvonne.
Y aquí estamos con siglos sin agua, es como. Pero para adelante, ahora pues, no es fácil.
He said there that, you know, here we are without light, without water, but we can only go forward from here. It's not easy.
Dale, cógelo como unas vacaciones cortitas.
Espera, porque no tiene compromiso.
Sí, yo sé.
Yvonne tells her uncle Gilberto to take it like a short vacation, oh. And he sort of smiles and says, yeah, but I have commitments. And then he invited us all to eat, but Yvonne wouldn't accept.
No, nosotros no vinimos a comer de tu comida, tío. Él quiere darnos comida.
Coman de la comida aquí.
Ay, no, tío, no, no.
Yvonne says she wanted for him to be calm and have faith that things will return to normal.
Honestly, that he invited her to eat, invited you all to eat in the midst of looking at 6 months of no income. So, Simone, I mean, okay, you and Jesse traveled with Yvonne Beltran. and you were visiting members of her family in Puerto Rico. How did all this affect her?
It's hard to say. I mean, like I said before, she had a mix of optimism and deep-seated doubt about what would become of all this. After we left this Uncle Gilberto, we ran into one of her cousins. He was out of work. He actually works for the government, but the power at the building he works at was down, so he wasn't working, wasn't getting paid. Now, this is a young, strong, professional guy, maybe in his mid-40s, and he told Yvonne that he wanted her help getting to the States. And I felt that, you know, if this is the type of person leaving Puerto Rico, who's going to be left to rebuild the island?
And just to remind folks, all of these people, all of these stories that you just went through with us, this was all on your first day on the island.
Yeah, it was.
Wow. Well, there's 4 more days worth of reporting from Simone and Jesse coming up on WBUR over the next coming days and weeks. WBUR reporter Simone Rios, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
And WBUR photographer Jesse Costa, thank you as well.
Thanks.
We've got both Jesse's images and a day log that Simone kept already on the website. We've got links to all of that. Take a look. It's at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Linda Nathan is a nationally recognized, multi-award-winning Boston educator. She is the founding headmaster of Boston Arts Academy, a pilot school, and the city's first public high school for the visual and performing arts. And during each of her 14 years at the school, Linda Nathan says she made a promise to her ninth graders. All of you will graduate from high school and go on to college or a career. And by the way, Boston Arts Academy was pretty darn successful at that. But Nathan says as the years passed, she grew uneasy about her promise, her assumption that surrounding students with the promise of college could prompt them to achieve it. Well, it didn't sit as well with her as it once did. Instead, she saw a host of factors, both visible and invisible, that could bar a student from college, factors that had nothing to do with how hard they worked or how apt they might seem. And Linda Nathan's written a new book reflecting on her experiences. It's called When Grit Isn't Enough. A high school principal examines how poverty and inequality thwart the College for All promise. And she joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you.
So, Linda Nathan, this book is, I mean, it's a deep analysis of certain trends in education and things that we're seeing and possibly not seeing. But it also, tell me if I'm reading this wrong, it also seems like kind of you, in a certain sense, holding yourself to account.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
For messages that you were giving to students at Boston Arts Academy.
Yeah, I think it's very rare that people in my position get to reflect on what they've said and why they've said it and how they've said it. And this, my own children were going through college. And you can't tell on the radio, although I say it in the book, I'm a white woman and I'm a woman of privilege. And my children didn't have any of the issues that my students had.
Yeah. But I mean, but on the surface, if you just look at the numbers, for example, Boston Arts Academy does very, very
well. Boston Arts Academy does, it's one of the best in the country.
Yeah, I mean, almost 100% go on to some sort of post-high school career or college, and or 65% of those college-bound actually end up enrolling.
Mm-hmm.
2/3 of those students graduate. So
what's
the problem?
What's the problem? Well, I think, you know, when we set up this school, the promise was this 100%, and I think when I began to analyze what was happening with some of our graduates, even those that finished college, the journey that they had taken and the hardships that they encountered, and I felt it was really important to tell those stories.
Well, I'm definitely going to ask you about some of the stories because they are incredible, but I do want to first just, there's a key shift in thinking that you kind of ask us all to go through right here in the top of the book. You say, how do schools, particularly under-resourced schools, best prepare our students for successful careers and or college? Okay, a good question, one that's frequently asked. But then you say, or said differently, how do issues of access or equity shape our students' post-high school experiences? Now, I would say that that reframing is not actually one, perhaps, that's discussed as much as it should be.
And that's why I wrote the book, because that's what I feel like we all need to be asking ourselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, Okay, so with this idea that college for all or postgraduate careers for all or just, you know, telling kids no matter where they come right. from, who they are, what their family right. background is, I mean, are we misleading students?
Well, I feel like, you know, as I think about it today, it's not that what I said was wrong, nor would I tell any principal you shouldn't exhort your kids to go on to college, because we all know that you earn more money if you're a college grad than if you're not. But I think what I'm trying to get us to think about are these structural obstacles mm-hmm. that really prevent our students from being successful in college. And then what do we need to do, both high schools and colleges together? Yeah. How do we reshape the narrative? And certainly the reason the book is called When Grit Isn't Enough is because one of the most, I think, discouraging things that's been going on for the last 15, 20 years is this mantra about grit will just get you there, as if race and class, money has nothing to do with how you can be accomplished or not.
Right, and it's a major part of the right. book. Because let's just dive straight into the question of grit, because it is very, very common here. You spoke with dozens and dozens and dozens of students, visited schools mm-hmm. also. And in the chapter about grit, which you called Just Work Harder, mm-hmm. you also talk about some of the students that you knew at Boston Arts Academy. Can you tell mm-hmm. us the story of Clara, mm-hmm. right?
And I may not be able to get each story correct, because of course all of them are pseudonyms, and so right. and I don't have the text in front of me, but is there something about that story that you're thinking about?
Well, but it's a young woman who you knew very well here.
Who doesn't go on to college.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. Because her mother's undocumented.
That's right.
Yes.
Right, right. So there were so many, you know, she's one of many. And you might say she was grittier than all the rest. And that's why that, you know, ethos of grit just makes me crazy. Just because we tell kids to be gritty, just because we put the college banners up on the classroom walls, which is not something Boston Arts Academy does, thank goodness, you know, as if that's going to get kids there. No, it's much more complicated than that. And I'm trying to get us as both educators and citizens and policymakers to see that it is so nuanced, so complicated, you know, and those are the kinds of stories I tell. You could read some of the stories in the book and say, well, shouldn't the adults have known better? Hmm. Shouldn't the kids have known better? And my answer is no.
Right. I mean, in Clara's case, there was no way for the adults in her life to know better.
No.
This is okay. So you say here for you know that she struggled academically, because she's an English language learner. But her mother cleaned homes. Her little brother was doing all right in school. Needed a lot of attention. Her older brother had been deported, mm-hmm. so a lot of disruption.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. But nevertheless, you put her in the chapter about grit, about mm-hmm. perseverance, mm-hmm. and how and why this is such a powerful pedagogy now in so many schools. So can you give us some examples of schools you visited where this is in action?
Well, I think I tell some stories, particularly a story of a third grade class that I visit where the classroom teacher aborts the lesson because the kids aren't doing their slant thing well enough. And that's sit up, let me see if I can do it, look, ask questions, nod, track. So the kids aren't doing that. And there's nothing like inherently wrong with that. But that's become the pedagogy that we're now teaching.
Yeah. So let me just say a little more detail about that particular story, because it has a big...
those kids don't
I
get to go to class.
I have a big highlight on it next to it. Because, yeah, so it's a group of third graders who are sitting down and they are... they were really looking forward to watching a video about snakes.
Right.
But it's just two kids in the back who are having a case of the wiggles. And this is their third grade.
Right.
I mean,
right.
in most third grade classrooms... that's par for the course.
I would say.
But because of that, because they weren't showing some form of self-control, self-regulation, the entire class got...
Was because that's the theory of the broken windows, and that's the way that teacher had been trained. And that's a lot of the norm right now, that if we don't get 100% compliance, particularly black and brown boys or bodies, then we're going to not do school the way we should.
But you also talked to a teacher who you know, who mm-hmm. taught in a I believe, a suburban middle school, who then moved to a Boston school.
Right.
A charter school.
Right. A no-excuses school. But she loved it.
And she said it works,
though. She loved it. She said, I can teach here. Yeah. So I'm trying to, you know, show the nuances of this. She thought it was fantastic. She had great control, and kids walked in straight lines, and they went up the arrow one way, down the arrow the other way in the classroom. It was incredible. I visited that school.
But you also visited schools where, these examples are burned into my mind now, where young students on the walk to lunch had to hold their arms across their chest.
It's called hugs and bubbles.
Yeah.
Right. So they hug themselves and then they put their mouth like they're holding a bubble. And again, nothing inherently wrong with that, except where I followed those kids was to a silent-only cafeteria.
And that was how it was every day.
Every day.
Okay, so in your opinion, as you write in the book, it didn't so much feel like school as it did like a prison.
Right, right. And I think this is not happening in the suburbs ever, and this is not happening in non-urban schools, and that's code for Black and brown and poor kids.
Mm-hmm. So this, we're talking about sort of the self-regulation part of it. And I should note that you point out that most of the students that you talked to, as you said, were students of color. Mm-hmm. But were there teachers?
In these schools, no, all of the teachers were white.
Is that problematic?
Well, for me it is. That, you know, what are we saying and who gets to discipline and why are we disciplining in this way? And can we think about what this means from a race perspective or a class perspective? And what does it mean about who gets to have fun anymore?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, but this idea of grit, perseverance, self-regulation, maybe we've been, I think that folks might think we've been talking about too narrow a scope of it.
That's right.
Right? Because it's much bigger than that.
Of course. I mean, you can't be successful if you're not exemplifying grit. You know, we know that. You can't, you know, look at yourself. You're incredibly successful. You work very, very hard. You obviously persevere. There's nothing wrong on the surface with these terms, but how we've taken it, particularly in urban education, I think we've, just like how we've gone too far in high-stakes testing, we've gone way too far with this notion of if you're gritty, you will get to college.
Yeah.
And we actually say that to kids, and that's wrong.
Okay, so but what is it masking then? Because that's what you're trying to...
What is this grit?
Yeah,
thing
the
masking?
Focus on grit, is it sort of preventing us from seeing that, you know, just soldiering through?
Well, I think it's masking. I think how it got so popular is a way to say we don't really have to solve the problems in our urban core. We don't really have to think about spending more money. We don't really have to think about what does it mean when you have one guidance counselor to 350 kids. So it's a way of saying, if you're just gritty, and this is what Teach for America did so well. I mean, they're sort of, Teach for America and the No Excuses are sort of married in my mind. And many of them are now saying, well, we need to reach can't. We don't mean that really. But I think it was all a way to say we don't really have to spend more money on poor kids.
Hmm.
So that's, to me, what it's masking.
Well, I want to play a little bit of tape here because, you know, this is Boston, so we have a lot of educators and we do a lot of conversations on education. And a couple of years ago, 2013, 2014, we actually spoke with Scott Sider, and he was the author of a book
called he's a good friend.
Character
yes.
Compass.
Yeah.
How Powerful School Culture Can Point Students Towards Success. And he talked about efforts in three Boston area schools, Roxbury Prep, including Roxbury Prep, a charter school. Mm-hmm. And this was the point of his compass where he was talking about effort, diligence, and teaching grit. And here's what he said.
So what I think you see happening at Roxbury Prep is this incredible sort of focus on this message that effort determines success. Mm. And so every week at Roxbury Prep, the students participate in advisory, where there's a lot of opportunity to practice a particular skill or a particular academic area. And then every week there's a community meeting, which is an opportunity for performance. And what you see is that students are practicing in advisory what they are then performing each week at community meeting. And I think the goal of the school is to really strongly underscore this idea that the effort you put into preparing, like the perseverance that you demonstrate, the grit that you demonstrate in preparing, pays off in a professional and polished performance. Mm.
So that was Scott Sider from back in 2013, 2014. Again, and I just ask you, like, that's another view of...
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Right.
No, there's nothing
but
wrong with
written
that.
But you've written a whole book that says there is something
so
wrong.
So what I would... I think we have to get to the nuance of it. It's not enough.
Yeah.
It's not sufficient. You're not going to get to college without working hard. But what I think I'm trying to say is just because you're going to work hard doesn't guarantee success. Mm-hmm. And we have to be willing to peel back that onion and talk about that.
So I'd love to talk about another aspect of how no amount of hard work will get you there when you have certain obstacles in your path. And it comes from the chapter about money. And you tell the story of a young man from Boston Arts Academy named Raul. And he got into college, the first in his family to get into college. And
I'm nodding. I remember this story.
So tell us the story about what happened to Raoul.
Well, and again, this is one of those ones that the audience could hear this story and say, well, he was dumb. How come he didn't realize? You know, he gets the letter. He's got a full tuition scholarship. He's in. For him, that's it. He literally bounces over, you know, the divider to my office to tell me, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in. And he doesn't pay attention to the fact that he didn't get housing. So he assumes that he's going to live with his brother. And he doesn't know that his brother doesn't live near to his college. So when he, you know, and again, you could say, but how could he have not known? And how could he have been so, I don't want to say, well, just how could he have not known? And how could we have not known? But the fact is, his story is very, very common. He's not the only kid that's told me. And then I get there and they say, we'll take out a loan.
Yeah.
Because he's not going to go back. He's already got the sheets, the towels, the blankets, the pillows. He's going to go to college. He's done the reading.
Well, so let's just underscore some of the things here, because I think the details are so so revealing, right?
Yeah.
First of all, you write very touchingly about how he goes to buy, you know, supplies for his dorm room. Mm-hmm. And you reflect on your own experience, right? Because the list of things required for just dorm life are long and expensive.
Right.
And that's a
big
deal for his family.
Right. But he does. Yeah. He gets it.
And then later on, when he comes back, because he's not in college, and again, he got a full scholarship for tuition.
Exactly.
And he says, well, I didn't have housing. And you ask him the questions, but hadn't you known that there would be cost to housing? And he says sincerely, no, I assumed it was covered.
Right.
They never told me.
Right.
And then you said, well, wasn't there paperwork? Didn't you get letters? And he said, I guess so, but I knew they'd just given me a scholarship. I thought the bill was just showing what it would cost if I hadn't had the scholarship.
Right.
Now, when I read that, to me, I was like, well, in lots of other families whose parents went to college, they'd look at that bill
and know
exactly what it meant.
That's right. But he, you know, he's from a family that he's the first to go to college.
And he says he arrives at school with his luggage and his new pillows. And on registration at the first day, he learned that in order to move into the dorm, he needed to pay $14,000.
Right. So he takes out that loan.
So what happened?
He's still not in college.
But he has the loan.
Right. I think he will be working in a low-wage job, and this almost makes me cry, for the rest of his life. Yeah. And he's not uncommon. And that's the part I want the audience to understand and my readers to understand. He was about the grittiest, smartest, most amazing young man I've ever known.
I gotta ask you, though, was there a role for Boston Arts Academy?
Sure.
Here?
I blame myself every minute of every day. How could I have not said that one extra thing? How could we have missed this? Of course there's a role. But I write this story not to flagellate us, not to say we're the worst people in the world, but to say, because he's metaphoric for the next time something like that happens. And that's what I'm really trying to say in this book. It could have been that. In the first book, I write about Shanita, who doesn't pay her deposit, mm-hmm. and she's really the touchstone for this book. There are so many stories of things that happen to kids like Raoul, like Shanita, that we are unable to pay attention to because of the sheer volume.
So then what are the things that we can do? Because the challenges that the fundamental challenges you're writing about are so profound.
Yeah.
The challenges of poverty,
yeah.
of inequality, of yeah. instability.
Well, one of the suggestions that I do make in the book is I do believe, particularly in a city like Boston, we could, with all of the nonprofits and the schools, there's 3,000 seniors in Boston, we could make sure that we retool how all of the nonprofits that work on college access work with our schools and our seniors. And I really do think then we would have the personnel. Either that, or we got to get those guidance numbers down so that it's not 1 to 100 or 1 to 350, which is what it usually is. So that's my suggestion, is that we really think about all of the personnel we have, and we can have a list of questions a mile long. There will still be until we get better at this, because we're not good at it. You know, if you went to college yourself, you don't know what that question is that you're not asking, right? You don't think to say, you didn't send in your deposit? You didn't know that if you didn't send in that $500 deposit, they'd give up your seat? The answer for most kids who've never done college is no. Just like with Raoul, no. Yeah. I didn't know. So we have to keep asking ourselves, keep interrogating, what are the questions that we should be asking?
I love how, I love the practicality of this suggestion. It seems very actionable. Like, yeah, we could do this.
I think we could.
But what you're also getting at here, if I could just circle back to where,
sure,
we started, like, there is a really deep movement in education right now where kids are getting the message that really, like, in the grand tradition of American individuality,
right,
it's all about you.
Well, that's the issue, right? So until we can say, no, it isn't about you, it's about us, and it's about us together. Because if you're from a middle-class family with college-educated folks, you've got a lot of people, and I quote a New York Times article in the book about this, you've got a lot of people taking care of you and a lot of people picking you up when you trip. If you're poor, if you're first gen, you're on your own. And this grit, whatever we want to call it, philosophy, says it's all about you. And I think that's just patently unfair.
I mean, you conducted more than 80 interviews, mm-hmm, right? And that,
yeah,
that was just with the Boston Arts Academy grads?
Yeah, I made the decision,
yeah,
not to use other kids because,
yeah,
these were the kids I really had a relationship with.
And it's remarkable because, like you say, with all of them, similar ideas and, mm-hmm, and words and phrases came up. And that's actually how you end up organizing,
right,
the book, right?
Right.
Five beliefs or assumptions that frame their successes and their failures. Money doesn't have to be an obstacle. Race doesn't matter. Just work harder. There's a college for everyone, or everyone can go to college, and if you believe in yourself, your dreams will come true. Now, Linda Nathan, just allow me to quote what you say after that. You say that these ideas hold almost mythological power for Americans.
Right.
But you question, what's their function? How do popular media substantiate or contradict these assumptions? And deeply held beliefs frequently go unchallenged in societies. They're how we explain phenomena or culture. And they are often false, yet they persist.
Right.
What is the danger of these ideas persisting? And because they are so fundamental, do you see?
Well,
I was going to ask if you were going to be if you're pessimistic or optimistic.
No,
about
I'm always
us
optimistic. No, but I think that they allow us, unfortunately, not to change systems and structures.
Yeah.
Right. And so I'm writing this to say, come on, we got to have some different conversations here. If we continue to say to everyone, it's up to you individually, then we're going to continue to get the kind of results. And even though the Boston Arts Academy results are fantastic, they're not what everyone wants, and they're certainly not what most urban high schools get. And I think when we individualize everything and not talk about it as systemic failures, then we can't change the systems in front of us. I mean, no one in their right mind thinks it makes sense to have one guidance counselor to 350 kids. But that's, yeah, what we've got, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy. And then we say, all of you are going to go on to college? How's that possible,
hmm,
when we don't have the wherewithal to provide that support? So either we say to the nonprofit community in Boston, come on in. We're going to divide it up so it's 1 to 15. And you're going to stay with those kids from sixth grade all the way to senior year and make sure that they got a plan after high school, whether it's college or a career. We could do that in this city.
God, it makes me think that there's so many opportunities. Like, maybe, like, we have thousands of professionals,
yeah,
professionals around.
Yeah, yeah, we could change this.
Who could just volunteer and, like,
yeah,
be matched with a kid for their junior,
yeah,
and senior year. And
we
just,
could,
like,
train them all.
Every letter you get from a college, let me read it.
That's
so
right.
I could tell
That's
you what
right.
the right questions
but
asked
we'd have
are.
To train them.
We'd have to train them.
Right. And I think we could do
I've
that.
Got to think that there's the motivation in a,
yeah,
city like this to do that.
I do
that.
Too. Well, hence why I wanted to write this book, because I sort of want to make it a alarm bells. Like, what? How could this happen to Raoul?
Yeah.
No. We can't let that happen. But I also don't want us to ignore the fact, and I like what you say, you know, we can't make it so it's an impossible thing. If we don't acknowledge these, what I call myths, and they should be, you know, in air quotes, race doesn't matter? Really? In this era, race doesn't matter? We better be able to talk about race in our high schools.
Yeah. Well, Linda Nathan is founding headmaster of the Boston Arts Academy. She's executive director of the Center for Artistry and Scholarship and author of When Grit Isn't Enough, A High School Principal Examines How Poverty and Inequality Thwart the College for All Promise. It's been a great pleasure to
Thank
speak with you.
Thank you. Really
Thank
an
you
honor.
So much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The man who was at the center of a landmark Supreme Judicial Court decision about immigrant detention is back in the news after being arrested for assault and battery and unarmed robbery. Shrey Nguyen Lun was the plaintiff in Lun v. Commonwealth, the case earlier this year where the SJC ruled that local law enforcement does not have the authority to keep someone in custody based solely on detention requests from federal immigration officials. WBR Shannon Dooling covered the Lun case and is here with the latest news. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so a potentially complicated story. It feels like it got just even more complicated.
Yeah.
First of all, remind us why the decision by the SJC was such a big deal.
Sure. So, I mean, like most things that involve immigration law, this case before the SJC was really complex. But in its most basic sense, as you mentioned, the court was deciding whether or not local law enforcement can keep someone in custody who's otherwise free to go just because federal immigration officials ask them to. So that's what's known as this ICE detainer request. So Lun had a previous conviction on breaking and entering, but in February, his case was he was back in court on larceny charges. Those larceny charges were dropped. They were dismissed. ICE officials still asked a judge to hold Lun on a detainer so that ICE could pursue his deportation. So it was the legality of that detention that was at the center of the SJC decision. And ultimately, the court decided that Massachusetts statutes don't provide local law enforcement with the authority to hold someone who otherwise would be free to go.
And obviously, this made national news because the Trump administration has been saying that the ICE detainers are important for safety.
Exactly, that they're important safety mechanisms. So ostensibly, this was a pretty big blow to Trump's national immigration agenda because it really basically said to local law enforcement here, hey, you aren't allowed to enforce these ICE detainers that the president and Attorney General Jeff Sessions say are a key part of cooperation with the federal government. Our state laws just don't give you the authority to do that.
Okay, but this was the SJ decision on ICE detainers, mm-hmm. and Lun was released even before the court had rendered it.
He was, and this is another one of those layers of complexities, I guess, with this case. So Lun was held for 3 months by ICE while they were trying to deport him. He's the son of Cambodian parents, but he was born in a Thai refugee camp in Thailand. So neither of those countries recognize his citizenship. And so as such, he's stateless. He couldn't be deported. So ICE was holding him while still trying to find a place to send him, basically. But the problem is the Supreme Court says you can't do that. You can't detain someone indefinitely. So ICE released Lun back in May. And then this last week, he was arrested for charges of assault and battery and unarmed robbery of a 65-year-old woman in a wheelchair.
I see. Okay. So the reaction, what has it been to this most recent arrest?
Yeah, as you can imagine, both sort of sides of the immigration debate are kind of clamoring right now. So I think because this was such a high-profile case, folks who advocate for more stringent immigration policies are saying, hey, we told you so. We need these ICE detainers to keep criminals like this guy Lun out of our communities. So here's Jessica Vaughn. She's with the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates for less immigration.
This shows the problem when law enforcement agencies are forced to release individuals instead of holding them for ICE. The problem is they end up being sent back to the community and have the opportunity to reoffend.
But of course, on the flip side, advocates for immigrants are saying, well, wait a second, Lun was released by ICE because he couldn't be deported. And the SJC decision in his name was a separate matter. So here's Ava Malona, who heads up the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition.
As much as the anti-immigrant forces will try to politicize the arrest of Mr. Lun, it has nothing to do with the Supreme Judicial Court case about his unlawful detention.
Right. So Malona is basically saying here that you can't draw a straight line from the SJC decision to this recent arrest. In fact, Lun was held on that ICE detainer, if you recall. Mm. So both sides are sort of positioning here for sure.
So, okay, as usually they might. Mm-hmm. That's not entirely mm-hmm. unexpected. Mm-hmm. But Shannon, do you think this arrest could have any long-term impacts?
Well, it's interesting. I think we're going to keep hearing about it. You know, I think we'll hear more about Lun's arrest from these folks who are sort of quote unquote anti-sanctuary city. I think we could see it come up on Beacon Hill. You'll remember there are three bills before the legislature right now, two in response to the SJC decision that seek to actually create statutory authority for local police to honor ICE detainers. One of those was submitted by the governor. And a third actually goes to the opposite end of the spectrum and says we should become a sanctuary state, which, of course, would limit cooperation with federal immigration officials even further. So we'll be watching all of that.
As we will. Mm-hmm. WBO reporter Shannon Dooling, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Finally today, it's Monday, which means it's Common Health time. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBR's Common Health, is here, and she's here to talk about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, also known as the notorious, well, to some, I would guess, the notorious RBG.
Right.
But you're not going to talk about her legal decision.
No, I'm going to talk about her health, which is, of course, a matter of great concern to everyone who wants her to stay on the Supreme Court for as long as possible. Saturday Night Live even joked about it last November.
Realistically, how long do you think you can hold on?
Oh, forever, Colin. I'm eating an apple a day to keep Ben Carson away. And by apple, I mean pure human growth hormone.
She is tough. And Justice Ginsburg's health is particularly buzzworthy right now because of a new book that officially comes out tomorrow. It's called The RBG Workout. And on the cover, it says, how she stays strong and you can too. And it even comes with a stretchy green resistance band. Here, I'm snapping it for you. With the logo, The RBG Workout, right on it.
Okay, so two things, though, before we move forward. She's 84.
Yes, she is.
That's
84.
Why people are concerned.
Right.
And just to provide journalistic balance, I'm going to say there are some people out there who, or lots, who probably think she should step down and retire. So, yes. So,
okay.
Concern, different kinds of concern on all sides.
True.
But let's get back to the science.
Okay.
And the actual exercise.
Yep.
What is the RBG workout? How does she say so FIT?
So FIT, well, because she basically kicks butt. So her workout is a very solid, it's a balanced workout that includes cardio, weight, strength training, stretching, core work, balance, all that good stuff. But the truly impressive thing is that she does full-on push-ups, multiple sets of like 10 reps each. She does one-legged squats, which is like, it's really hard. It's like sitting down on a chair with one leg up and, you know, standing on one leg and sitting down and getting up from a chair. And she recently started doing planks. I mean, she's like an iron octogenarian.
This show, while I love it, every day I feel like I'm provided reasons to feel bad about myself.
If you can't do as much as Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you are pathetic. Anyway, and she gives loads of public credit to her personal trainer since 1999. His name is Bryant Johnson, and he actually wrote the book. And so I asked him the really obvious question today. How does she do this? And he says she is tan.
And when I say tan, she is tough as nails. Her resistance, her just tenacity. I remember talking to the justice about this recently, and I told her, I says, well, Justice, if nothing else, I hope the message will get out that you're never too old to really start working out and exercising the body. So they can't use age as an excuse.
And Megan, I also spoke with Dr. Eddie Phillips of Harvard Medical School. He's the chief of physical medicine and rehab at the Boston VA. And he was my co-host for the exercise podcast we did last year, The Magic Pill. He says one thing that's especially impressive is how Justice Ginsburg has progressed over the last 18 or 19 years of training. Like, she went from doing push-ups just leaning against the wall to push-ups on her knees to now multiple sets of full push-ups.
What Justice Ginsburg shows is that, indeed, you can get stronger at any age, at 65, at 83, and I suspect, and with the science shows, that she'll be doing a workout at 93 and still adding muscle and still adding capacity, functional capacity. It also keeps her mentally sharp and extends her life.
So many questions, Carrie. Okay, let me stick with the simple ones.
Yeah.
How often does she do this workout?
So only twice a week. And I spoke about that with Professor Wayne Westcott. He's the director of the exercise science program at Quincy College and a big exercise researcher. His work finds that working each muscle group twice a week is generally enough. It's generally as good as three times a week. And he says as people age, they don't recover as quickly.
So for people over age 50, let alone over age 80, typically we recommend not training the same muscle groups more than twice a week because they won't fully recover. So if she's doing a total body workout, which she certainly is, twice a week is perfect for her.
And because of Wayne Westcott's research, he's not surprised that she got so much stronger even at this advanced age.
Age does not seem to be a factor in responding to the strength training stimulus, as long as you get plenty of
protein, because older people don't assimilate protein as well.
Now, the book doesn't talk about her diet, but I bet she's smart about that.
She's like writing Supreme Court decisions on one hand and pounding protein shakes with the other.
But
seriously, her weight has been in the news in the last, what, day or so?
Yeah.
Because of comments the president made.
Right. He reportedly made comments about her. This is according to the news website Axios. Citing multiple sources, Axios reports that President Trump said he expects to be able to replace Justice Ginsburg during his term. And Axios quotes him as saying something like, what does she weigh, 60 pounds?
But she is slight.
She's
petite.
She is petite. But, you know, as her workout shows, that doesn't mean that she's necessarily weak or frail. I mean, it is a problem when older people lose muscle mass. It's called sarcopenia. It's not good. But if you're doing strength training, you're offsetting that. You can still stay strong. And so both Wayne Westcott and Dr. Phillips say what's important isn't size. It's body composition and muscle mass.
Okay, last quick question for you. Are you going to do the RBG workout?
But it looks really hard. also, I just want to share my fantasy. My fantasy is push-up contest, RBG against Donald Trump.
Oh my God. I'm just going to leave it at that. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health, thank you as always.
Can I add one more thing? If you're going to do this book, start slow.
Start slow. Okay.
Yes, thanks
a lot, Carrie.
You're welcome.
We're going to go out with the other Notorious. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Yeah, Papa M.